With that all said, I've got a question for you that doesn't really seem to relate to anything I've said thus far. How many zones can you think of? Now, while we were driving up here, we drove through construction zones. So that's a zone. Then we had to go through numerous school zones. I like the way they do school zones in Vancouver better than here in Oregon. They have flashing lights with a big, easily read digital readout with a 2 and a 0 to remind you to drive 20 miles an hour through the school zone. In Oregon, they don't always have the flashing lights. They have just your standard low-tech sign, and people don't pay attention to it. And if you don't pay attention to it by accident, you pay dearly. It's like $600 to be speeding through a school zone. And it's just fair. Those are kids that are going back and forth across the street. Years ago, around hospitals, they had quiet zones. Then they learned how to do insulate walls, and it didn't need to be a quiet zone around hospitals. Iraq has a no-fly zone, which we impose on Iraq. So there's another zone. I guess Afghanistan is pretty much a no-fly zone right now, too. No-fly except for the USAF and the Royal Air Force. They're allowed to fly. For those of you who date back in your current events knowledge to the Vietnam era or Korean era, there is a demilitarized zone where the different parts of the country were divided. They have a no-man's land called a demilitarized zone. Of course, in order to have a demilitarized zone, you have to have a battle zone first, and so that you can militarize the demilitarized zone when you choose. We have speed zones when you're entering a city, and throughout the town, you'll have a speed zone, various ones. There was a book called The Erogenous Zone written years ago. There's another guy that's written a lot of books. They must be important, but not important enough yet for me to read them. But they talk essentially about fitness and health, and he talks about getting in the zone. And I tried to figure out what zone he was talking about, and by skimming the book, he was talking about getting into a fitness zone, where you're exercising. And he talks about a mindset, getting your mind into a zone. Of course, we all know of another mindset, and that's being zoned out. And it's like about after watching the fourth hour solid of television, whatever comes on, you sit there staring, and you're kind of zoned out by that time. But that's a mindset, too. It's called a, you know, you had no-fly zones. Well, that's a no-fly, a no-mind zone, as the zoned out. But a mindset zone has to do, and there was a series of books by the zone author, about diet and behavior, the way you think about yourself, the way what you do, all that sort of thing. As you well know, and maybe you've thought of this zone already, for those particularly of our teens and young adults who either are campers or staff at our United Youth Camp program, we have the zone at camp. And by the zone at camp, we're talking about something that is akin to a foretaste of the kingdom of God, where it's a safe place to come, a positive place where people try to be supportive of each other, where it's a friendly place that you can come and learn new things and do new things and enjoy the camp experience, whether it's one of our summer camps or what is going on even as we speak in Wisconsin, our winter camp. It's a good place. That's what we mean by the zone when we talk about the camp zone. I want to talk about another zone today. This is a zone that we all have. And in fact, you are in it even as we speak. I said that before, didn't I? It's called your comfort zone. It's what you're comfortable with, what you're used to. It's the way you presently live, your sort of normal mindset, your basic behaviors, the things and events that are familiar to us. Seldom does it include anything new. Once you've established a comfort zone, then you have an automatic bias built into your life, and you really are a little uncomfortable at adding anything or changing anything in the comfort zone. My wife's brother lives in Sisters, and they attend in the Bend congregation, and they raised registered Malamutes. And Malamutes are beautiful dogs. I had one once. Tried to bite my arm off, and then tried to bite somebody else's arm off, and I don't know, then it got lead poisoning, and the first thing you know, it croaked. But I've always regretted the death of that dog. I wish I'd have skinned him, because he had such a fine pelt. Would have made a magnificent wall hanging. But, you know, I guess we have to let some things just kind of go that we regret. However, they have a different bloodline of Malamutes than that one was from. He was not a very reliable dog. And they've had some smart dogs and some dumb dogs over the years in raising them. But they've got one now. This is their main dog. His name is Quan. Quan is short for about 18 syllables. It's one of the syllables out of the 18. And Quan is the smartest Malamute I ever saw. In fact, he's probably as smart, almost as smart as any dog I've ever seen. He's 130 pounds, black and white, classic Malamute. He's a champion Malamute, gets to go to dog shows and come back with ribbons around his neck and that sort of thing. Marvelous dog is Quan. But the funny thing about him, he's the only one of their dogs that they pretty much let come into the house from time to time. He comes into the house and he'll go through the rooms looking at everything. And he memorizes where all the objects are, all the furniture is, the piano is, the chairs, the benches, all the other things and whatnot that they have in the house. And when he comes in the next time, he goes back around checking where everything is. And when he finds something out of place, he stops. This is not in my comfort zone. I'm used to the way things are. I've never seen a dog memorize objects like that, but he does it. He'll memorize them, and when there's something new, and he'll immediately stop, and he'll walk around it, eyeing it suspiciously, and finally decides it's safe, and so he then sort of reprograms his comfort zone, and off he goes. That's where it should be from now on. Now, if it's moved, then he has to stop and look at it again the next time he comes in the house. Interesting dog, but we're a lot like that. We get this everything we're used to, and we like it there. In fact, sometimes I think Quan is more adaptive than we are with our comfort zones, because he reprograms his without too much trouble. Comfort zones are an obstacle at camp. You know, every summer we work with our campers, but some of them don't want to try new activities. They're not comfortable doing that. It's not in their comfort zone, so to speak. They're not ready to move into what we might call the challenge zone. They want to just do what they're used to. They don't want to try to meet new people, and they don't want to take the risk of trying to make new friends, because they're happy the way things are, and they don't want to step out and try things, and we try to encourage them to do that. That's a big part of the camp experience. Making the jump from the comfort zone to the challenge zone of life is fascinating, and it's exciting. Many of us find it hard to make that transition. But you know, we're not alone. If we go into the Bible, you can find a list of comfort zone heads. That's what I call them. The way we're all comfort zone heads. We're all zoned into a certain way of living, and we just don't want to change any aspect of it. But there are some very famous comfort zone heads of the Bible that I'd like to bring it to your attention. Notice one. This would be no one less than Moses himself in Exodus chapter 4. I think you know most of this story, but these are the crux verses, the key verses to the little story of how Moses was comfortable with the way things were. He had retired from being, the prince of Egypt, and he'd gone to being the shepherd of Midian. And down in the Sinai Peninsula at that time, and he was happy with that, and he didn't really want to change. And God showed up in the burning bush and said, okay, Moses, this is the plan. You're going to spring the Israelites from the Egyptian prison of slavery. And Moses thought, well, oh, okay. And then he starts having second thoughts. He realizes, boy, that means I've got to give speeches. That's outside my comfort zone. You know, we have men's club, and sometimes it's like pulling teeth to convince men they need to be in the spokesman's club to learn to communicate. But once they get in there, once they try it, it's not so bad. But that's a big jump from your comfort zone to the other one. And so in verse 10 of chapter 4, Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, and he probably stutters. Imagine this. He probably throws some stuttering, some Mel Tillis talk in the middle of there. I'm not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant. You know how it goes. But I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. And God said, listen, Moses, who made the tongue? Who made the teeth? I can help you in this. You know, you can do this thing. And he goes on and he says, now therefore, I will be with you in your mouth and I'll teach you what you shall say. And then Moses keeps arguing. He says, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send, but don't send me, is the message. Moses wanted to stay in his nice, comfortable zone and be a comfort zone head the rest of his life. I call his version of the comfort zone the somebody else zone. Send somebody else. Anybody else. My brother Aaron can speak. Send him. Just don't send me. That means I'd have to take a risk and go and do something. Or what about Jonah? Jonah was a comfort zone head. It's back to Jonah chapter 1. Jonah is right after Obadiah, in case you've forgotten where he is in the Bible. No doubt your Bible will fall right open to Obadiah. It's a page long. Jonah chapter 1. Now you know the story of Jonah. I know, I think the story of Jonah, we learn that when we're really small, before we even get to be teenagers. Almost all of us learn that. Everybody almost in society knows the story, the basic story of Jonah, and how he was sent by God to preach repentance to the Assyrians in language the Assyrians would understand. Repent or die! They understand that. A little bit forceful for the rest of the world, but the Assyrians, that was the only sort of thing that got through, and that's what Jonah had to tell them. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of, saying, arise and go to Nineveh, that great city, that would be the capital area of the Assyrian, developing Assyrian Empire, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. This is God speaking. But Jonah said, I ain't gonna. Jonah didn't, his comfort zone could be redefined as the I ain't gonna zone. So instead of going where God said, he just took off. And he went the other way. So Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish. Tarshish was clear across the Mediterranean on the coast of Spain. That's where he was going. As far away as he could conveniently get. So he jumped the first ship out of Israel and headed for Tarshish. From the presence of the Lord he fled. And he went down to Joppa, found the ship that was going to Tarshish, and he paid his fare, and he went on to it and with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Well, you know the rest of the story. God had to pull rank, go fishing, and take Jonah back to the shores closest to Assyria, closest to Nineveh, and have him sort of barfed up on the beach, you know, amongst all the other stuff that was inside that huge fish's stomach. And that had to be a little ignominious, but probably pretty scary being inside the fish. So Jonah's comfort zone was an I ain't gonna zone. I ain't gonna do that. That's Old English for I'm not going to do that. And it didn't work. But there was another one. We're not done with the comfort zone heads. The people who were comfortable in their life and they really didn't want to make the changes that God needed them to make. Gideon was another one in chapter 6 of Judges. Gideon, we should identify with a little bit. He was a Manassite. And the United States of America is descended from Manasseh. For the most part, so, you know, this is a man who was in the ancient version of our own culture today. Now, this was a time when the Midianites and the Amalekites were dominating the Israelites. In fact, they were basically had them at their beck and call, constantly terrorizing the land, robbing the people. So they were hiding. They lived in caves and wherever they could to get away from these marauding bands of Midianites and Amalekites. The angel of the Lord came and said, as in verse 11 of chapter 6 of Judges, he sat under the terebinth tree. Terebinth tree is a terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, one or the other, I'm not sure. If it was in the middle of the afternoon, it's probably Ophrah. Terebinth tree is just a big tree with big, wide, spreading branches providing some shade, which was a premium thing to find in the Middle East then as it is now. And it belonged to a fellow by the name of Joash. And while his son Gideon threshed in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. So Gideon is a bold man. A threshing floor where you're separating the wheat from the chaff is typically done on a flat rock that's been smoothed off and get all the trees and brush cut down from around it to where the wind can kind of blow through there freely, and you're flipping the chaff and the wheat in the air, and then the wind will carry the chaff, the bits of straw and the hull of the grain away, and you'll catch the wheat or the barley or whatever, the oats that they're winnowing there. But Gideon was afraid to do it up in plain view of anybody that could see him on a hilltop. So he was in the wine press. Instead of being a flat spot carved on a rock, it was a hole carved in a rock. So he's down in this wine press, which would be either a round or maybe a rectangular or square sort of hole that the Israelites would just carve out of a piece of limestone, and that's where they crushed the grapes, and they'd have a little channel to bring the juice then down into the vat that they stored it in to let it ferment to make wine. So he was down in there. It's not a very efficient place to winnow the grain, but Gideon wasn't a bold man. He was hiding from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him. So the terebinth tree was nearby, and that's where the angel of the Lord appeared. Now, either that was God himself, the God of the Old Testament, sometimes that's a reference to that, or it could have simply been an angel like Gabriel or Michael or someone. And he said, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." Sometimes I think there's a little sarcasm in that. Hiding in the wine press, winnowing grain. "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." And Gideon said to him, "Oh, my Lord." You know, he's surprised, and so he speaks respectfully. He says, "If the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? Why are all his miracles, his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites." And the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" Now that would build the case that it wasn't just an angel carrying a message, but that it was the Lord God of the Old Testament making a famous appearance directly and personally with Midian. And he said to him, "Oh my Lord," Gideon hadn't tumbled to that little note in the comment. He says, "Oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest of Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. I'm a nobody. I'm not even Joe somebody. I'm Joe nobody." And the Lord said, "Surely I will be with you, and you will defeat the Midianites as one man." You know, here's the message from God giving this carte blanche, as it were, of power to Gideon to do this mission, and Gideon doesn't get it. That he's not comfortable with that. "I'm just a little old guy in Manasseh. I'm sort of out here in ancient America, and I'm nobody, and I don't really want to move out of my comfortable zone. I like hiding. You know, I like to sit in my room and do my video games on the computer, or I like watching TV for 8 hours straight, or whatever it is where we like to sort of hide from the rest of life around us." And so he said to him, "If I have found favor in your sight," Gideon says, "then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me. And don't leave until, here I pray, until I have brought out my offering and set it before you." As you're going to find out, this meant that the angel of the Lord had to stand there for a while. And he said, "I will wait till you come back." So Gideon ran and he prepared a young goat. That goat was living, and so it wasn't living when he got it there, and he had it cut up in pieces and probably eventually tanned the hide. And unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. An ephah is about 20 pounds of flour. Now that's a lot of unleavened bread. "Go down to the store and pick up enough tortillas to equal 20 pounds. Gideon was busy making these things, you know, getting them ready and bringing them. And it was an offering. "If you're really who you say you are, then wait till I bring my offering back." So he brought the goat, and it all prepared, and he brought the basket of all the flour, or all the flatbread, the unleavened bread that he made, and he brought the broth from the goat as well. So maybe he had to boil the goat in the pot. So this was a long time later, hours perhaps. And he brought them to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. And the angel said of the Lord, or God himself more likely, said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock." So there was a convenient rock. So Gideon dutifully laid them there. "Now pour out the broth." Either that means God doesn't like broth, or he does, depending on where he meant for it to be poured out. But chances are, we know he had a staff in his hand, and he probably took the staff or reached out and pointed where to pour out the broth. and like as not, it was on top of the unleavened bread and the meat, soaking it generously. Then, this is something that began to sort of move Gideon out of his comfort zone. The angel of the Lord put out the end of his staff that is in his hand, and he touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire arose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. Just whoosh! You've got this massive flame not coming down out of the sky this time. It's just coming off a rock that's been soaked with goat broth. And you know, goat broth is like about as good a fire extinguishing agent as you're going to come around. And it's all this soggy bread. And it's all burned up in a flash like that in front of him. And Gideon's sitting there and saying, whoa, I haven't even seen anything like that in commercials, let alone these programs I've been watching. It convinced him. Well, this must be a message from God then. And then the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. Well, then that put Gideon into a little bit of a fearful mode. Instead of the Idawana mode, you know, he says, you're going to defeat the Midians, and Gideon keeps arguing against that, but I'm nobody, you know, I don't want to do it. It's not me. Send somebody else. I ain't going to, not me, please. Gideon begins to break out of his comfort zone, and the first mission is to go out and destroy the pagan idols in the community. So he did, bravely, gathered up 10 men who he knew agreed with him in following the true God. And they went out there in plain sight and tore down the idols of the village during the middle of the night. They were brave. They made them make a powerful statement. Needless to say, Gideon was almost out of that comfort zone. He was beginning to take the challenge, but he wasn't really ready to make that sort of jump to light speed, because God sent him another message later. And he said, now I want you to gather up an army, and you're going to go and destroy the Midianites and the Amalekites, the combined forces. And Gideon said to God in verse 36, if you're going to save Israel by my hand, as you said, look, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor, and if there's dew on the fleece, and it's dry on the ground, then I will know that you'll save Israel by my hand. I need to know for sure. I really don't feel comfortable in wiping out the entire Midianite army. And, you know, when you throw the Amalekites in there, it's just no way. It kind of makes me crawly just to think about doing it. And God says, all right, put the fleece out on a rock. Next morning, he wrings out a whole bowl full of fleece, probably into the bowl that he had the goat broth in before. So there's a lot of, probably, God's poetic, you know. And I'm guessing that's what it would probably be. And so you think, all right, man, that's incredible. Everything else is dry, but the fleece is soaked. Anybody should know, okay, now, it's true. We got to do this. You know, he'd get out there and give that General Patton speech and get his men stirred up, and off they go to find the Midianites and the Amalekites, but not Gideon. He says, okay, that's good. I'm almost there. But, you know, he reminds me of the character on the Jackie Chan movie Shanghai Noon. What's the other actor's name? His character, Roy O'Bannon, that's it, the character name. Kind of fishtailing around, sort of a 70s kind of guy that just can't make a commitment to do anything for sure. And you almost get excited about it, and then he backs down. Well, that was Gideon for you. So God, he said, okay, please don't get mad at me, God, but what if I put the fleece out tonight and it stays dry and everything else gets wet? Okay, do it. It happened. So finally Gideon got out of his comfort zone after all this encouragement and all these incredible, miraculous signs, and then he was willing to get up and do what needed to be done. Elijah was another comfort zone head of the Bible. And you think, well, no, hold it. No, Elijah was a brave man. Elijah, I remember reading about that. Well, where was that? And you think for a minute, and you come up with 1 Kings chapter 18, and, my, that's pretty good. Elijah took on the entire priesthood of Baal. All those bad guys that worked for Jezebel and King Ahab. How could Elijah be a comfort head when he was... you know, confronting all of them and confronting Ahab, and he prayed and no rain came on the land for 3.5 years? What do you mean he was in his comfort zone? Elijah, in spite of the fact that he was doing the right things, in spite of the fact that he was pretty brave, still had a comfort zone that he couldn't break out of. There was one thing that scared the living daylights out of Elijah. And that thing was a she named Jezebel. Now, in chapter 18, Elijah wipes out 450 priests of Baal, does a very public, powerful demonstration of God's power in burning up another wet sacrifice that had been made to God, an offering that should, had water poured all over it. But that time the fire came down out of heaven instead of up from a rock. And finally the rain, he sat down and he prayed, and his servant was sent seven times to go and look to the east, or to the west rather, to see if the clouds were coming. In the meantime, the sky became black in verse 45 of clouds and wind, and there was heavy rain. And he had just told his servant, go to Ahab the king. He said, prepare your chariot and get out of here before you get stuck. Because when it rains, it's going to rain. So Ahab rode away, and he was headed home to Samaria, and he had to go down to the valley of Jezreel, and the hand of the Lord was upon Elijah, and he girded up his loins. Everybody wore robes in those days, so if you wanted to go for a long run, you tucked your robe into this big belt you wore around your waist so that it wasn't sort of flopping on your legs all the time. You know, it made your own sort of jogging pants out of it. And he took off running, and he ran ahead of Ahab's chariot, which was pulled by horses. He ran ahead of that for 13 miles. Elijah was brave, zealous. He was strong. He was confident. He had a good wind. 13-mile run ahead of the horses. That's pretty good. But when Jezebel threatens his life, he just melts. And so Ahab told Jezebel that Elijah had all that he'd done, and this is in chapter 19, that he executed the prophets with a sword. And Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, so let the gods do to me and more also. She put it in the nastiest, wicked witch of the West voice you can imagine, or whatever Jezebel says. If I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. And when he saw that message, he arose, and he'd already run 13 miles. He ran for his life to Beersheba. That's Jezreel. That's 50, 60, maybe 65 miles to Beersheba, down on the southern edge of Israel. And then he laid down there and he prayed that God would just take his life. You know, I just can't take it anymore. I'm just dealing with Jezebel, just freaks me out. I can do all these other things. I'm comfortable with that. But when it comes to dealing with Jezebel, I can't do it. And so God sent an angel. And when he woke up from a deep sleep, there was some food there cooking. He says, now eat it, drink this jug of water, and take another nap. And he did that. And then he got up and he traveled on the strength of that food for 40 days. Fasted 40 days. Went down into the to the south where Mount Sinai was, and went to Mount Sinai, and then God appeared to him there. First, God came by, and there was a great wind that broke the rocks, and a wind that breaks rocks is a pretty good wind. You've got to stop and think about that for a minute. Rocks don't usually blow in the breeze. Trees blow, branches blow, but rocks and break them? That was really a pretty good wind. You know, you'd have to take your hat off to that wind, or it would take it off for you, as the case might be. And then, God wasn't in the wind. Oh, that's nothing, God says. And then there was an earthquake, and God wasn't in the earthquake. He said, earthquake, smurfquake. I do that all the time. And then there was a fire. Now, this is up on a rocky crag of a mountaintop. What burns on rocky crags? Nothing obvious. So a fire is sort of out of place there. It's extraordinary. And God says, yeah, fire's easy. But after that, it was like somebody was outside the cave Elijah was hiding in, talking quietly. And suddenly, that got his attention. The other stuff, you know, he's in there cowering and fretting about Jezebel, and, you know, he's just not comfortable doing anything else. He just wants to lay down and die, and there's somebody out there. So he puts his mantle over his face, and he sneaks out to see what it is, and the voice came to Elijah. And the voice said, this is the voice of God, what are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here? Sounds like Dr. Laura, you know. You did what? What are you doing here? And so Elijah defends himself. Well, I was very comfortable with being zealous of the Lord of hosts because of the children of Israel forsaking your covenant and tore down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword. And I'm the only one left, and they seek to take my life. And I'm just not comfortable with that. And so what did God say? Well, you can read what he said in the rest of the paragraph. He said, I want you to go to the wilderness of Damascus. You're going to anoint Hazael of the king of Syria. And then you're going to go and anoint Jehu to be king of Israel. And so on and so on and so on. I've got a few things for you to do. It's like he said, Elijah, deal with it. Get over it. You know, an awful lot of our problems come from being uncomfortable with stepping out and doing something we need to do. And you know what God essentially is telling us? Get over it. Now, there are some people who have, you know, real serious difficulties and they need some help getting over it. But for the most part, an awful lot of our problems can be dealt with just like that. Just get up and go out and do what needs to be done. Get over it. Deal with it. And he said, besides that, you aren't the only one in verse 18. I reserve 7,000 people in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. You're not alone. You have friends. And most importantly, I'm your friend. And so what did Elijah do? He said, okay, I'm ready to take on the challenge. And back into the battle he went and trained somebody to be his replacement. That was Elisha. He accomplished great things. We know he accomplished great things because we read God's stamp of approval, that the GSA of the New Testament, in James chapter 5 and verse 16. It's in the chapter where he talks about praying for God's healing. And it says right at the end of chapter 16, the second half, it says, the effective fervent prayer of the righteous man avails much. And Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it wouldn't rain, and it didn't rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months, and then he prayed again. And the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced its fruit. Well, you know the rest of the story. It was after that that he got spooked. But after God helped him get out of that comfort zone by telling him, okay, Elijah, what are you doing here? Get over it. Deal with it. Now let's get back to work. We have more things to do. Gave him that pep talk. And the first thing you know, Elijah was back at it doing incredible things. Now, meanwhile, back at youth camp. At youth camp, we want you to redefine your comfort zone. Suddenly, Elijah's comfort zone was redefined. All right, I can deal with this Jezebel thing. You know, I pray to Baal, that's not a problem. King Ahab, I can deal with him. I can outrun his horses. But now I can deal with Jezebel too. And whatever else I need to do, I can do it because God's going to help me do it. And he did that through prayer. We want to redefine your comfort zone. We want, when you come to camp or even when you're on staff at camp, we want you to enter, to take on new challenges, to enter the challenge zone. To make, when I say redefine the comfort zone, you spread its limits out to where it takes in challenges. If your comfort zone is such that you're willing to do things that need to be done, and you're willing to take on a new challenge, try a new activity, meet new people, and make new friends to add to your old one, then you have a bigger comfort zone, one that works better than the little scrunchy one there in the middle of the sofa in front of the tube. That's what you want, a big, great big, widespread comfort zone that lets you take in challenges and take on challenges. You do that, and you end up having a wonderful experience at camp. New activities, meet new people, make new friends, learn new things. You try to answer questions the ministers ask in Christian living classes. That's a challenge. I love throwing questions out when we're teaching the classes to find out whose hands are going to go up to try to answer them. Some of the questions I know are hard questions, and that maybe nobody can come up with the answer, but I like to see who will try, who will take the challenge to try. Most of the questions I know you can answer. It's a matter to have this kind of a comfort zone that includes challenges. It means you're willing to take the right risks. There are a lot of bad risks in the world around you, a lot of temptations, we call them. Those are bad risks. They're stupid risks. But there are right risks. Getting up to do the right thing, to learn new things, to be more effective, to be happier, to make others happier. And when you take the right risks, you will enjoy the right thrills, the right satisfaction, sense of satisfaction, because you are engaged on the quest for rightness or righteousness in that sense. You know, Jesus said something like that in John chapter 14 to the disciples, and you read the story of the disciples, they were an interesting bunch of guys. You know, they're just not a lot different than we were at first, but they sure did some great things in the course of their lifetimes. And we are in as incredible a time as they were. John chapter 14 and verses 12 and 13. Jesus said to the disciples, this is shortly before he's to be arrested, leading ultimately to his death. Truly I tell you, he who believes in me and the works that that I do, he will do also. You do what I did. And greater works than these he will do because I go to my Father. He says, my human life is ending. But if you believe in me, if you trust me for guidance, and you take on the challenges, you will do greater things than I've done. Because I'm going to work through all of you, and you're going to have more time to do it. And whatever you ask in my name, that I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. And if you ask anything in my name, I will do it. So when you're facing the limits of your comfort zone, and those limits are just way too close to you, and they need to be stretched out to encompass challenges, you go to God and you ask him for help in reaching out and doing the new things that you need to do. Now that's summer camp. That's a few months away. What about today? Well, tonight we have a dance. And for some of our teenage guys, there are a few of them, frankly, their comfort zones are plenty big when it comes to social events. There are a few who are not. And so the idea of asking a girl to dance is about as foreign as being able to read the instructions and fly the Mir space station. And by the way, it's not flying anymore. So it's about that far away. So tonight's a challenge, a time to take a challenge, to reach out and stretch and redefine your comfort zone, to get acquainted with teenagers that you haven't gotten acquainted with, even though you've seen them at the Northwest Weekend for the past 3 years. Go and meet those that you don't know the names of. Do new and good things and become one of the really big comfort zone heads of God's people.